Mr. Campbell, Reel 5.
Charles Coilangi and other chiefs, of which there weren't all that number who were unequivocally on our side, so to speak, would have been unenviable, but he would have certainly had protection. He would have had armed protection from us. And he was a very brave and upstanding chap altogether. One felt about many other chiefs that I met amongst the Kikuyu that while they supported the Kikuyu Guard, one always felt that they might well be hedging their bets and therefore less threatened. I'm perhaps being unfair, and that certainly there were a number of them who were very good and who certainly stuck their necks out, but nobody more than Charles.
Did you see evidence of the attacks which Mau Mau carried out against the Kikuyu?
Oh, certainly, yes. We had a terrible massacre in which a number of people that I had engaged outside the straightforward Kikuyu Guard and called them the sort of Elder's Army, in which a Mau Mau gang descended on a boma. A boma means a whole lot of huts surrounding a central hut, and put petrol on them and burnt the whole lot down, including all the elders and women and children in the place. And that I certainly saw.
So they burned them to death?
They burned them to death and cut them to death.
Where and when was that?
That would have been in the Kikuyu district, and I can't remember exactly when, but I should have said probably in 1954, 55. Yes, I can't remember the date.
Why had they done this?
Oh, because in the same sort of way, again, the IRA is a perfect example. They wished to deter assistance being given to the enemy. I mean, just as they are a bump off, quote, informers, unquote. So they were trying to withdraw support from the administration.
But at what stage did you feel that Mau Mau was being got on top of in your own area?
I think that one definitely had the feeling that in Kikuyu there were diminishing cases of this sort of thing happening. There were people being arrested all the time. But I think the big step forward was actually a little later than this, when really it was coming towards the end, and the terrorists remaining in the forests were largely hiding from being caught rather than doing anything positive, was when we started to bring people into villages. Instead of having them living on small homesteads all over the district, we brought them into villages which were then could be supervised and therefore could prevent help being given as easily as they could do in individual houses. I mean, there's obviously no parallel in Northern Ireland to that. But that when they lost the material support and general sympathy of the villagers, who by and large, in any case, quite apart from villagization, were getting immensely tired of the whole exercise of the military, of the policing, of all the things that happen, they had rather changed heart and were against it all. And that would have been in 1956 when I'd moved to my last post in the central province in 1956, that's right, in 56 was the beginning of the end.
What was that last post?
That was the division of Karatina in the Nyeri district.
What impression did you get of the degree of effectiveness of the army forces that were brought to bear on the problem?
I think that the army, by and large, just as it is nearly always in practically every example that you can take throughout military history, a conventional army is nearly always lumbering when you compare it with terrorist forces. They are very badly equipped to do so. And the only way that you can get anywhere was a way led largely by a chap at that time who was a major, who said that the only way we're going to do this is to infiltrate and go with blackened faces into the woods. Suddenly his name has escaped.
Frank Kitson.
Frank Kitson was the originator of what I call the equivalent of infiltration, such as perhaps one might imagine that the SAS has been doing in Northern Ireland. And I think that was when the real success, largely done by Kenya Regiment, who were, again, you see, in a better position because they were recruited locally and generally could talk to Africans, because very few Africans spoke English. And his success with that, it isn't a perfect parallel, because although there were Kikuyus who would infiltrate, and though he took patrols with blackened faces so that they could get much closer than they could, it was largely infiltration and intelligence that won the battle in the forest, and the denial of support in the homelands. Those two things led to the end.
Do you think that the Mau Mau could ever have succeeded?
Oh no, no way. No, it couldn't. I don't think there's any way that it could. I mean, all right. That perhaps is an open-ended remark. The real question is, they quite possibly did. Because although the present president of Kenya is in fact Kipsigis, Arab Moi, the Kikuyu have dominated the political scene ever since. Was that partially attributable to the uprising? Was it attributable to the indoctrination by Kenyatta? I think it's arguable, and I think it will be argued that is possibly true. But that they could have had a military victory, of course, was impossible.
Who was Eliud Mathew?
Eliud Mathew was the first Kenyan to become a member of Legislative Council. He had a quite incredible brain. He was educated at outstanding boarding school run by the Church of Scotland, the Alliance High School at Kikuyu, whom I got to know very well because they were in my first division. And got a degree in Balliol. And a remarkable thing showing the, should we say, the mind of the Kikuyu, or Africans in general, whereas I think critics might say that they could ape or imitate or had memories and were not as intelligent, I don't agree, but he did something which would have been a remarkable feat in any newspaper. When he sought to go to Oxford, he was told at that time that he could not do so without a school certificate in Latin, with a credit. So he took Latin as a subject and got a credit in school certificate in 3 months. And then went to Balliol, came back, and as I said, was the first African member of the Legislative Council.
Did you get to know him well?
I never knew him well, no. I think I might have just met him. I met several people who subsequently became and knew quite well people who became ministers in the first independent, like Charles Waruhu and James Gichuri, Gichuru, who was also at Lowndes High School. But Eliud Mathew, I may have just met, I can't remember.
During Mau Mau, how much support do you think that you were getting from both the administration in Nairobi and from the home government in trying to put things right?
I think that it certainly was an all-out effort as far as Nairobi was concerned. I think that I'm going far deeper than any sort of personal reminiscence could ever take one in saying what I thought about the home government. I think that we, and now I'm talking about the whole of the administration in Kenya, always believed, with a great deal of reason, that the Colonial Office simply didn't understand what was going on. They did do something at this time. They began to send out people and attached them and got them to work. But previous to this period of the Mau Mau emergency, people worked in the Colonial Office in London without ever having had any first-hand experience of colonies at all. That, I think, differed them from the Indian Office, though I don't know. So that although one can say yes, they certainly gave military support, and they undoubtedly must have given some financial support, I don't think that there was any sensible direction from London. It should be said, however, I think that it was, after all, the stated intention, not only the belief, that independence was the objective of the colonial government. We knew that, and our purpose in life had always been, ever since I was in the administration from 1949 onwards, was teaching the Africans to run themselves, with never an idea that there would be a permanent colonial administration. So that much of what was done by the Colonial Office, and the first person who did seem very sensible was Ian MacLeod, who took the first step towards independence. And the steps that they were taking and the assistance they gave was directed towards that purpose, and so wasn't hindering.
What about relations between the district officers and the white farmers? Were they united during the Mau Mau emergency?
And the answer to your question is, broadly speaking, no, they never were. There was always a fairly sharp division between the settlers and the officials. The settlers felt that they were the only, that they were there, that their lives were there, that they had contributed more to the wealth, because after all they paid taxes. They also felt wrongly that they knew more because they had a lot of African employees. And they generally distrusted people whom they considered came one day and left the next, although that wasn't quite true, because people generally spent their entire life, or their entire working life, from university to retirement in the colony. It was, I think, improved, but not to any great extent, and it was something which concerned me a great deal, which is why I eventually, when allowed, towards the end of the emergency, joined the Kenya Regiment, because I felt that it was important that it should be seen that members of the administration could be in something which was a white organisation at that time, and where we were both joined together. But broadly speaking, there was always a division between the settler and the official community.
What did Christian missionaries play any role during the Mau Mau emergency, from your own personal recollection? Were there any in your area?
Oh, yes. I'm afraid to say that I hate to go on record on this, being a Christian myself, or a so-called Christian, at least an attending Christian, let me put it that way, that on the whole, the missionaries, who had a better claim to understanding Africans than most other people, because they were deeply involved with them. There were very few Europeans with a very large number of Africans. They generally spoke the language. Their attitude was, as you might expect, exaggeratedly liberal. In other words, their sympathies would have been automatically with the blacks. Just as you might find that, although I don't want to get drawn into an argument about South Africa, as you would expect it to be, a certain degree of bias. Beyond that, the thing that I think that disappointed me in my time in Kenya, not only in the emergency, was the very strong competition between the various denominations within the Christian religion for numbers. Now, you might, perhaps that's a little bit cynical. They wanted numbers rather than souls. They wanted to say, we have converted. And they were not beyond bribing people with sacks of posho and so forth to enlist in the Church of Scotland mission or the Catholic mission or whatever. A few missionaries, such as I met first, were absolutely honest. And one old Irish father said, I'd asked him how many people he'd converted since he'd been there and how long he'd been there, and he said he'd been there 30 years and he thought he'd converted one. But generally speaking, they didn't play a negative part. They didn't hinder our work to any great extent. They didn't assist it particularly, although of course they were naturally against terrorism, as you would expect. I hope that's answered it. I can't go much further.
But you say a liberal role, but presumably they were they trying to make the Africans into Europeans, or were they more or less accepting that the Africans could go their own way?
I don't think I ever got involved in any arguments about this. I think that they were certainly not trying to turn them into Europeans. I think that they were, the majority of them, very anxious for them to become Christians. I think that anything less than that would be untrue, although, as I said, the distortion came in the sense that they would talk in terms of successes to their home, Church Missionary Society or the Apostolic Fathers or whoever they were would say, we've got 554 and we've added 74 souls this month, type of thing. That is the cynical part of it. No, they were anxious to convert them to Christianity without any doubt, and not necessarily into white Christians.
What do you think that the Kikuyu movement and Mau Mau did for relations between the different tribes in Kenya? Relations between the Kikuyu and Maasai and Kamba and so on.
Very, very strangely, it's not a question that can be answered with a yes or no. The Kalenjin, those are the Kipsigis Nandi, those are the people who, generally speaking, are the finest sportsmen. All the names, or nearly all the names, there are one or two Kikuyu now, but nearly all the names of the Kenya athletic team are Kalenjin and Nandi. Who formed who were the majority of the police and the army, together with the Kamba. They disliked and distrusted the Kikuyus from the very beginning and were never sympathetic at all to their cause. The Mau Mau probably made them even more suspicious than before. The Maasai are relatively small, and for some peculiar reason that I've never been able to understand, they have married into. You've got huge numbers of Kikuyu married to Maasai. So you've got a slightly bastard tribe in the Maasai, and they never hated the Kikuyu, though traditionally and historically they had fought them and driven them into the forests in the pre-colonial days. And I would find it difficult to say what are the views about the Maasai today. Generally speaking, I would say, not having been to Kenya for 30 years, I would say that the Kikuyu are still distrusted and disliked because they are the most efficient and because they dominate the scene to a large extent.
Did the coming of independence, when it did, take you by surprise in any way?
I had left. I left in 1961. I mean, I knew that independence was about to happen, but it happened 2 years after I left. And it certainly didn't surprise me, no.
Now, during the war, to what extent did you feel that you were in danger from being killed or mutilated yourself?
Well, in the most peculiar way, early in the war, when I was a private, on leave in Devonshire, a German bomber, which I presume was unloading, dropped a bomb in the field of our house. I went down to look at the crater and found a fragment of the bomb which had 5-3-2-7-3-1, five of the six numbers of my army number. And I said, hello, this was the one that was intended to get me, and it didn't. And I felt, not deeply or religiously, but felt that I had a charmed life. This lived with me in virtually the whole way through.
Like not walking under a ladder?
Like not walking under a ladder. And the only time that it failed was for a brief second when I was blown over at the Battle of Alamein. And got a very small fragment in the joint of my thumb, but no wound. And as I was blown over, I remember thinking, I have been killed. I am now a war hero. My number is going to be on a plaque. This is it. And then I realized, 10 seconds later, that I'd just been blown over, and I just got up and pulled this piece out of my thumb and went on. But later on, in Popsky's in particular, I seemed to have a clear guidance that I could go in a certain direction and would be all right, and that I couldn't go in another direction. Now, this is perhaps extrasensory, whatever you call it, perspicacity, whatever it is, but it was very real and it was there, and of course it proved to be true.
I wonder, to finish off, if you could take me step by step through your own personal memories of the Battle of Alamein, starting with what rank you held and which company you were in, which unit, and so on.
I was a second lieutenant in B Company of the 7th Battalion of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders in 51st Div. I was sent up as a reinforcement, roughly speaking, in the middle of the battle. It was a most extraordinary experience to arrive there, because it was like something one had never seen before, just a sort of a desert with a few bits of scrub in it, slightly rolling, and bangs going all over the place. The platoon that I joined, I can't remember the number of it, the platoon commander, who was called Sailor Sills, had been killed the day before, and the platoon had been reduced from 30 to 22, with one of the people, as I arrived, called Yorkie, still lying dead. For the first part of the battle, we weren't doing anything. We were not advancing or retreating or anything of that sort. But there were quite a lot of shells flying, generally solid shells, and I had one very curious narrow escape, which perhaps even emphasizes the point that I told earlier, in that I was sitting in a trench, a fairly shallow one, and a person sitting at right angles to me with his feet towards me asked for a light to his cigarette. And I lit it and leant over, and as I moved that way, a solid shell blew the back of the trench out.
On the other side?
No, immediately behind where I was sitting upright, and I leant over to the right angles, to light the chap's cigarette, and the back of the trench where I had been before was blown out by a solid shell. It didn't explode, it just went straight through, I don't know what it would have been, 18 pounds or 6 pounds, I don't know what the Germans were firing. And then the next thing that I remember very clearly was that we had, on the first morning, we had bacon. And my feeling then was, how absolutely wonderful, I'm getting this free. And the third experience that I had was of Lorne Campbell, subsequently a VC, who had come out with the 7th Battalion from Dunkirk. There was lots of bullets flying all over the place. We were all ducking, and Lorne Campbell standing up behind a carrier, shaving, taking absolutely no notice whatsoever of the bullets flying, whilst we were sort of crouching down. The third experience was the worst at Alamein, in the sense that Lorne Campbell was rather pleased to get hold of somebody of the same tribe, if you like, and he said that he'd got a very interesting and exciting job for me to do. He wanted me to go out and at night bring a telephone line up very close to the German positions and then direct fire onto the German positions. We went out with our platoon ready to dig in on the skyline, and as we went, a group of Vickers machine guns, you could always tell them because of the particular noise that they made, was firing indirect fire onto the Germans. The Germans had no means of pinpointing, and they opened fire in the general direction, which happened by sheer misfortune to be where we were. So we were suddenly enveloped in a hail of bullets. And the chap who was reeling out the telephone line behind